Okay. Thanks, Moritz, for the introduction and for the opportunity to talk here today. So that's the title of the presentation, News from the Ultra High Energy Cosmic Ray Sky. So for many years in this area, we've been looking for signals of anisotropy in the distribution of ultra high energy cosmic rays. And for the disappointment of many people, we've bumped into a very isotropic sky. But the situation nowadays is that the current statistics, the current accumulated statistics, and all the knowledge that we gained in terms of systematics allows us to look for very small modulations in the flux of ultra energy cosmic ray sky. I'm gonna be talking here about the results of the Pierre Auger Observatory, which is the collaboration that I'm part of. So just a few words to introduce the observatory for those that are not familiar. We are a cosmic ray observatory installed in the city of Malargüe in Argentina, close to the Andes, in a region called Pampa Amarilla. And so the observatory has an area of 3,000 square kilometers, so it's pretty big, where we have installed about 1,600 detectors. So each black dot here represents one water shrink of tank. And the idea is that these tanks are able to sample shower particles. So if you have an atmospheric cascade propagating the atmosphere, as it reaches the ground, the relativistic particles in the cascade will induce the emission of shrink of light in the tanks. And then at the same time, you can see here in the periphery of the array four fluorescence telescope sites. So we do have 27 fluorescence telescopes at the end. So each site has at least six fluorescence telescopes. They are overlooking the atmosphere on top of this surface detector area. And the idea is that these telescopes are able to then detect the fluorescence light of the atmospheric cascade as these cascades cross the field of view of the telescopes. So it's basically that. So this is just a picture of how a water shrink of a tank looks like. It's just a plastic tank containing 12 tons of ultra pure water. We do have photo multipliers on top of these tanks. You have solar panels to provide the power, a GPS to have the time tagging. Because we want to measure the time that these particles reach the ground and also the deposited signal. That's how a fluorescence telescope site looked like with the six shuttles for each one of the telescopes. You can see the Andes at the back. Here's just basic information on how we extract information from these showers. So you have tanks at ground level that can measure the time when the cascade just reached the ground. So the shower front just propagates at the speed of light. So if you have a model for the shower front and you measure the time that each of these stations trigger, you can get the geometry, you can get the shower axis, right? That's basically what is plotted here. The time difference between the actual shower front and a plain shower front as a function of a distance to shower axis, and you basically see a parabolic behavior. So that tells you that the shower front is basically parabolic. At the same time, you measure not only time, but you can also measure the deposited signal. You just have the footprint of the shower at ground. So if you measure the signal and you have the geometry, the shower axis, you can then reconstruct what we call the shower lateral profile that gives us just the signal as a function of distance to core. The signal here is measured in a very special unit for us. It's called VEM. This is the vertical equivalent of muon. So this is basically the signal that a muon, a single muon, deposits in the tank when it crosses the tank vertically and along the axis of symmetry of the tank. And why am I showing this is because once you have the lateral profile, this curve here, you can get the signal at a very special distance, 1,000 meters from the shower axis. And the idea is that at this distance, the shower-to-shower fluctuation is minimum. So it's good to have a measurement of the signal at this point, or an estimate of the signal at this point. And this will be our estimate for the shower size. Once you have an estimate for the shower size, we can then determine the energy, the total energy of the cascade by an energy calibration procedure. That's basically. So this is how we do reconstruct showers that enters the atmosphere from 0 to 60 degrees. This is what we call the vertical showers. But if you look at more inclined showers, the situation is a little bit different. You still can get the geometry by measuring the time that the stations trigger, but the shower size, you cannot no longer use this approach where you basically assume that the signal varies continuous with distance to core. And the reason is for an inclined shower, it traverses a lot of matter. Then the electromagnetic part of the shower is basically attenuated. And what you have at ground level, it's basically sparse muons. So this model of a continuous function that gives you the lateral profile can no longer be used. You can see here also the differences between a vertical shower and an inclined shower. So the signal here is a combination of electrons, muons, photons, whereas here you have basically muons crossing the tanks. Yeah? You have a very sharp time profile. So the way we estimate the shower size for these inclined showers is using simulations. We simulate a lot of showers and get these reference muon maps at ground level. So these are basically muon density maps at ground level for different zenith angles. And you can see here the effect of the geomagnetic field that breaks the azimuthal symmetry at ground level. And once you have these reference maps, you can then measure the signal in the tanks and fix the normalization, yeah? and fit the normalization to these muon maps. And this is going to be our shower size estimator. And then you can, that's basically it. We also have these special events called hybrid events that are events measured both by the surface detector and the fluorescence telescope at the same time. Here is an example of it. So here is basically the signal in the camera of these telescopes. And you have also some timing information encoded in the color here. But once you have this kind of traces in the camera, you can then transform these into what we call longitudinal profile, where you have in the y-axis just the deposited energy in the atmosphere in ionization as a function of the death, atmospheric death in the atmosphere. And so once you have this profile, you can fit an analytical function, which is called Geiser-Hilles function. And once you have that function, if you integrate the area below this curve, it gives you the total energy deposited in the atmosphere in ionization. Once you have this energy, if you just apply a small correction due to the muons, so the muons produced in the cascade, we don't see them. And high energy muons, we also don't see it, but as you can correct this using simulations, then at the end, you basically have a calorimetric measurement of the energy in the cascade. So the atmosphere is basically a huge calorimeter.
How big is the energy band?
So the energy bins of the cascade of the total energy bin.
I see.
Before, in this muon maps, for example, here we do it. For different zenith angles. Here you have two examples, and we also do it. We do it at a fixed energy, which is 10 to the 19. Yeah, 10 to the 19. So the energy is fixed.
So this is like a single
thing? This is like a single thing. And then we let the normalization vary, and the normalization will be our energy proxy for these events. So the energy in real showers, the energy will be given by N19 in some sense. I'm gonna just give you a bit more detail on this, because with the hybrids, we do have a calorimetric energy measurement of the shower. Then, since these events are hybrids, they also are measured by the surface detector. Then we can correlate N19 which is the shower size proxy, to the total energy of the cascade. And that's basically our energy calibration procedure. Here there's several examples of different SD energy estimators, for example, N19, as a function of the calorimetric energy of the FD. And you see that there's a beautiful correlation for several of these different surface detector estimators. So that's basically our energy, how those our energy calibration procedure works. Again, we do have a vertical shower, a vertical sample. Sorry, the colors are different here. So the vertical sample is in gray here, and the inclined sample is in red. So why I have divided the sample into two? So the vertical sample in blue here, I'm just showing the relative exposure now on the sky as a function of declination for these two different samples. So this is basically what we have in terms of sky coverage for the vertical sample. And in red, it's the sum of the vertical plus the inclined sample. So again, the inclined sample is for showers between 60 and 80 degrees. So just with the vertical sample, we see we can see directions in the northern hemisphere up to 20 degrees in declination. But when we include the inclined sample, it can go much further. Well, we can go further up to 40 degrees in declination in the northern hemisphere. So this is about 30% more sky coverage when we include with respect to the vertical sample. And this is very important for the kind of analysis that I'm going to discuss here. So you can see just with the sky maps in this is equatorial coordinates, right? And this is the Earth's rotation axis, that when we include the inclined sample, we gain some nice sky coverage on the northern hemisphere. So this is just the energy spectrum that we measured after more than 12 years of data taking. So the numbers on top of each point here is the number of showers detected at each energy bin. So this statistics is great right now. And we see some very nice and distinctive spectral features here. So you see that at low energies, and low energies I'm talking about 10 to the 17.5 to 10 to the 18.5 electron volt. So the spectral index is about 3.3. And then there's a clear change in the spectral index at an energy here of about 10 to the 18.6, more or less. And then you have a strong flux suppression at high energies. So the spectrum is always falling, right? So just pay attention that the spectrum is being multiplied by each of the third here. So the spectrum is really falling fast. And there is a strong suppression here at the highest energy. So this is spectrum change, this spectral index change here at 10 to the 18.6 sometimes is interpreted in some models as a transition between the galactic component, which is dying out here, and the extragalactic component that is taking over here. So this is one model, one possible model to explain the ANCO. There are other models that says that the ANCO has nothing to do with this transition, with this galactic to extragalactic transition, that all these particles are extragalactic. More or less, they are more than that. They are protons, and this change in the spectral index comes from the way that protons lose energy when they propagate at cosmological distances by interacting with the CMB and producing E plus E minus pairs. So this is an open question so far in the area. What is the origin of the ANCO? There's also some open questions here at the end of the spectrum. What is the origin of this suppression? So this is consistent with the way protons or heavier nuclei also interact with the cosmic microwave background. At these energies, protons or heavier nuclei will interact stochastically with the CMB or with the extragalactic background light, and you expect such a suppression. But it can also be explained if you assume that the sources are running out of power, the astrophysical sources are running out of power exactly at this energy. And it turns out that this is not a coincidence, in fact. Given the astrophysical sources that we know, this is actually a very likely situation. So just a few words about this called GZK effect. So you might, maybe you already heard about that, but you know, the CMB with the temperature today of about 2.75, the average energy of the photons is 10 to the minus 4. In the frame where the CMB is isotropic, but in the rest frame of a 5 times 10 to the 19 electron volt proton, these photons, they got a Lorentz boost of 10 to the 10. So they are able to interact with protons, produce delta resonances that then decay into protons and pions or neutron pions. So because the cross section has a strong peak at around 1200 MeV, where you do have a delta resonance. So as soon as as protons reach this energy, if they can propagate by cosmological distances, they will start to fill the CMB. For nuclei, the process is a little bit different. Instead of this delta resonance production, the main energy loss process is the one that induces the nucleus to oscillate as a large dipole. This is called the giant dipole resonance, where neutrons and protons oscillate in phase opposition. And if you just analyze the energetics of this process, you end up concluding that the energy of the photon that you need on average to induce this kind of process is in the infrared region. So the CMB is no longer that important. So you need infrared radiation in order to induce this kind of process. And then what is important is the extragalactic background light. More precisely, the second peak here, which is people usually associate with the emission from dust, right? Dust absorbing direct star light and re-emitting in the far infrared. So this has a direct consequence in terms of the ultra-high-energy cosmic ray flux and anisotropies also, because if you look at the typical attenuation lens of a proton traveling at cosmological distances, that's what you expect due to E plus E minus pair production in the CMB. And here you have the delta resonance process. So at low energies, I'm talking about 10 to the 18 electron volt, you should be collecting, in terms of ultra high energy cosmic rays, you should be collecting contributions from basically the whole universe. But as soon as you reach this 5 times 10 to the 19 electron volt, then the mean free path should shrink very fast, and you then are seeing sources very nearby. So you expect that the universe becomes an isotropic at some point at very high energy because the horizon is short. Yeah? It's at the tens of megaparsec in length. And so here, to illustrate that idea that at the end of the spectrum, you might also have this thing that the sources might be running out of power. This is a very simple idea. In fact, it's one of those ideas where the beauty lies in the simplicity, right? So Hillis came up with this simple idea in the 80s that if these cosmic rays are being produced by an astrophysical process where you accelerate them in the source from basically from rest up to 10 to the 19 or 10 to the 20 electron volt, you need to confine these particles for a minimum time inside the source. So you need that the Larmor radius of these particles fit inside the source, right? That's a basic requirement. So there's got to be a relationship between the Larmor radius, the magnetic field in the source to confine, and the velocity of the particle inside the source. So this is a basic requirement for any astrophysical source to accelerate a particle to a certain energy. So these lines that crosses the plot here are lines of fixed velocity or maximum energy, for example. So imagine that you want to accelerate a proton to 10 to the 20, 21 electron volt, or the dotted line here is for a proton of 100 eV, 10 to the 20, and in green, iron. So that's basically the relationship between the size, the intensity of the magnetic field, and the size of the source. So if you have a very compact source, then you need a very strong magnetic field like those in neutron, magnetized neutron stars, like magnetars. But if the source is extended, then you can have more the magnetic field doesn't need to be that that intense. And then you plot the sources, the typical sources that are candidates for accelerating these particles. And you see that at 10 to the 20 or 21, you are already at the limit, right? So the sources that we know, they will, these are the typical maximum energies that they can accelerate. And of course, this is not the end of the story, because this plot says nothing about energy losses. When you put energy losses in the source, all these curves should be pulled down, right? So 10 to the 20 might be actually the maximum energy that you will be able to accelerate these particles. OK, so enough of introduction on cosmic rays.
So when you put this energy cutoff, how long do you assume that the source is burning energy or emitting?
Right. So yeah, this is a more complicated thing. I'm not a specialist on this kind of thing. But so this is the Hilles plot is the level zero requirement for any source. It will just tell you what is the maximum, really maximum energy that all these sources are able to accelerate. Then you should put a real acceleration process on top of that, and energy losses, right? And then it's more complicated. And I wouldn't even know the details on that. But it was just to show that that suppression at the end of the spectrum might be something to do with these sources running out of power at the end.
They can't accelerate to that high
energy. Yeah. So now I'm going to discuss some results on intermediate to some from small to intermediate angular scale. And small to intermediate here, I mean anisotropies at 1 degree up to a few tens of degree. For example, here, Centaurus A is an interesting source for Auger, because it's the closest AGN. Right? It's a few megaparsec from us, like 4 megaparsec. So it's an active galactic nuclei. So it's a natural source for us to look at it. So this is an analysis what we have scanned into two parameters. This parameter here is the minimum energy of our events, a low energy threshold. And this thing is angular window of a certain size in degrees around the position of Cn. So if we then, for each pair of energy threshold and angular window, we count how many events are inside a certain angular window for all the events above a certain energy threshold. We can do this in our data set. And we can also do this using isotropic simulations. Play the same game, just throwing isotropic events over the sphere and counting how many events falls within a certain angular distance from Cn above a certain energy threshold. Then you can calculate a binomial probability for that to happen and try to find a minimum of this binomial probability. And it turns out that there is a minimum here for an energy threshold of 58 eV. Remember that 1 eV is 10 to the 18 electron volt. For an angular window of 15 degrees, where we observe 19 events in our data set for this combination of parameters, and we expect 6 by chance from isotropic sky. And the binomial probability for that to happen is 10 to the minus 5, right? So this is not the final p-value of this analysis, because we have scanned the whole parameter space and tried to find a minimum, right? So you have to penalize for that because you have maximized the signal in your data sample. So the way to properly calculate the p-value associated to this analysis is to redo the whole game using just Monte Carlo and using just isotropic skies. And scanning over the parameter space and counting how many times at the end you find a probability that it's as small as this one. And it turns out that this happens once in 1,000 times. So this is the final p-value. So this is a 3 sigma signal, not a statistically significant. That with the current statistics that we have, that's the signal. It's a 3 sigma signal. So AGNs, active galactic nuclei, are a natural source for us. And a second class of sources, these starburst galaxies. So galaxies with a star formation rate larger than average. And people have studied these sources in the literature and showed that when you combine active galactic nuclei and starburst, you can, for example, basically explain essentially 100% of the diffuse gamma ray background measured by gamma ray telescopes. So here we tested this hypothesis that either AGNs or starbursts are the sources of ultra-high energy cosmic rays. So in some sense, the assumption behind here is that the ultra-high energy cosmic ray flux is correlated to the non-thermal emission photon flux from these two populations of objects. And we have selected two samples, one of starburst galaxies and another of active galactic nuclei. So for example, the starburst galaxies, we have used a list from Fermilab. Here the proxy for the ultra high energy cosmic ray flux will be the radio flux of starburst galaxies above this frequency here, 1.55 gigahertz. But we selected only the brightest objects where this flux in radio is above 0.3 Jamsky. And we ended up at the end with 23 galaxies. And here is the selection of active galactic nuclei. Here the proxy for ultra high energy cosmic ray flux will be the gamma ray flux from these AGNs above 50 GeV. And at the end, we end up with 17 objects up to 250 megaparsec. Most of them are blazers, which are AGNs with the jet pointed close to the line of sight. Mm-hmm. And here, the approach is a little bit different. I hope this is not too much detail, but we have built a likelihood to test this hypothesis. The likelihood is an unbinned likelihood test. So this is a product that runs over every single event in Auger. So for every single event, you have the direction on the sky. So the likelihood is a product of the exposure that we have in the direction of the sky times a model. And the model has two contributions, right? It has a contribution coming from the source, either AGN or starburst galaxy, with a certain fraction alpha, which we call an isotropic fraction. But there's also a contribution coming from isotropy, because the energy that we are going to scan through here, at some values, we know that the horizon is pretty big. So there should be contribution coming from essentially the whole universe, depending on the energy. So you allow for that by including explicitly an isotropic fraction. And then we also allow for this direction to be smeared with respect to the source, because we know that we have magnetic fields in between us and the source, and these cosmic rays are charged particles. So here we are not actually measuring these magnetic deflections, but we are allowing an effective Gaussian smearing with the theta in this model. So it's a two-parameter model, the anisotropic fraction and the smearing and the average error mass deflection. Right? And then we scan over these two parameters to find what is the best combination that maximizes this likelihood. In fact, the test is a log likelihood ratio test between two hypotheses. So in hypothesis one, you actually do have your model here with either AGN or starburst, and we test it against isotropy.
So for each energy bin, do you have like separate alpha and theta?
Yes. That's what I'm going to show here. The evolution of these test statistics as a function of the energy threshold. Right? So at every energy threshold here, we scan the whole 2D parameter space and find what are the two values that maximize the test statistic. And this is just the evolution of that test statistic with energy. For the two, in fact, three different models here, starburst, gamma ray AGNs. And we also include a third catalog for historical reasons because we have tested this in the past. So we also study that. So you see that there's a peak, for example, for starburst galaxies, there is a peak at threshold 39 eV, where test statistics reach 25, more or less. And you also see in red the corresponding result for the AGNs. So for AGNs, the peak is at 60 eV with a test statistics of about 15. Right? And here we also included energy losses because it turns out that especially for AGNs, in our sample, they go up to 250 megaparsecs. So you cannot neglect this stochastic energy loss due to interaction with the CMB or the EBL of the extragalactic background light. So we had to include, and you can see a huge difference in the results if you do include this energy loss as weight or if you don't in the case of AGN. For the starburst, it doesn't make much of a difference because these starburst galaxies are very close by. So energy losses are not that important, but for AGN, it makes all the difference. Huh? This is the thing.
These sources by their distance from us?
With this energy, in fact, with the energy losses, basically, there are energy losses included.
And it's also just to account for the fact that
it's 1/r². Yeah. Also that.
Yeah. So you have like redshifts for all of these sources.
Yes, exactly. Because you need that redshift in order also to calculate how much of the flux is attenuated. And here's just the for that energy threshold that maximizes, two different energy thresholds that maximize the test statistics. You can look how the scan in the parameter space look like. Here is the maximum of the log likelihood for an opening angle of 7 degrees in the case of AGN, and you have an isotropic fraction of 7%, and these are the numbers for starburst galaxies, an effective RMS deflection of 13 degrees and 10% of an isotropic fraction. So you see that most of the flux is coming from very far away, but you need 10% of that flux to be coming from starburst.
So for the AGN, do you always assume that the theta is much bigger than the BSF of this of the sources that you pick from the
of the PS? The sources are pretty much point sources for us. These sources.
Fermi has this BSF that kind of extended.
What I can say is that our PSF has about 1 degree. So the source compared to our PSF, it's a point source that we are seeing with this broad PSF.
And when you like for these post trial values, is that did you like check several catalogs on something, or is it really like? Would you say really everything is included?
Right. So here what we have scanned, right? So he's talking about you see that the pre-trial, right? P-value is 10^-4, but then we have to penalize for the fact that we have a scan in the parameter space.
And you also try different catalogs? Or
no, it's basically these two. Huh? We set up the...
A priori,
yes. So that we wouldn't need to penalize too much. Because if you start trying lots of catalog, at some point you will see something, right? This is the look elsewhere effect. But it turns out that for the case of the AGN, it's a 2.7 post-trial effect. And for the starburst, it's an interesting signal. It's about 4 sigma in the signal. So we get a follow-up on that. So this is the kind of analysis that can be improved if you have a full sky coverage. And I'm going to say something about that. Here's the final, so these are, for the best fit parameters, these energy threshold for AGN, for starburst, and for that combination of RMS deflection and an isotropic fraction, this is how the model looks like. So if you just subtract the isotropic fraction, that's what the model tells you, what the flux is. So you see that for the AGN, you are dominated by 10A, which is this closest AGN at 4 megaparsec from us. The Starburst galaxy model, it has contributions from more sources. There is NGC 4935 here, M83. There's a source, bright source here in the north, in the south galactic pole, which is NGC 253. There's NGC 1068. And you can compare it with the observed excess in data. How well your model describes the data. So you see that there's lots of structure here at a smaller scale that is not predicted by the AGN model. And pretty much the Starburst model describes relatively well the excesses that you see in the data. And
what is the top panel? Sorry.
Right, yeah, so.
So you just taken like actual like counts and then subtracted off. Sort
right.
Of
you just add the you take every all the events in OG above 60 EV. So you smooth this with that in this case 7 degrees. The best fit was 7 degrees.
Right.
Yeah. For the AGN, and you put and basically you at the end subtract the isotropic fraction, right? And that's what the excess would look like because you have subtracted the isotropic fraction. This using the data.
It's cross-correlated with your like input model on the bottom. This is just you know what the data.
What the data looks like, and then you go and you see what your model looks like using AGN, and using Starburst. Yeah, so you see that there's a hole in the sky here. So this is the region of the sky that we don't see in the northern hemisphere. And we know that there are powerful sources here, especially. There are powerful starburst galaxies in this region. So if we had full sky coverage, this is the kind of analysis that can be really improved.
Does this include this incline?
Yes, yes. And
where would be the if there were no inclined
show? If there were no inclined show. In galactic coordinates, we would probably lose something like this, more or less, all these regions here. So the inclined sample helps a lot, but we still have a hole in the sky in the northern hemisphere. So if we combine, for example, our data sample with this other ultra-high-energy cosmic ray observatory in the northern, which is called TA, this is the kind of analysis that can get very interesting. And then, so the rest of the talk, I'm going to talk about the large scale anisotropies. Before really showing the results, here are the previous limits in the amplitude of a possible equatorial dipole. So if you take all the directions of cosmic rays project into the equatorial plane, what would be the amplitude of this projected equatorial dipole as a function of energies? So here at the highest energies, there are a bunch of upper limits, most of them coming from Auger. So you can see that we are typically looking for anisotropies at the 1% level in terms of amplitude. There was a signal here, a signal from this AGASA experiment that Auger could never confirm. So this was the situation before the measurement I'm going to discuss. But then I'm going to say just a few words on systematics and just to give you an idea why this result took more than 12 years to come up. It was not just a matter of statistics, but along these 12 years, we had to understand several systematic effects that could give you fake signals at these very large scales. So for example, for a detector like Auger, we know that our trigger rate is modulated by atmospheric effects, like pressure and temperature. When we look at the average number of events per day per square kilometers for as a function of the day, for every day, we see clearly a modulation with a one solar year period. If we look at the rate of event, but now as a function of the hour of the day, we also see a modulation of our trigger rate. And this is the kind of effect that can give you dipoles on the sky, for example. The reason for that is when you have a solar, like a 1 year solar modulation times a diurnal modulation, right? This can be seen as the interference between two time scales, one sidereal and one anti-sidereal. And this is a problem because this is usually the time scale where we look for true anisotropies in the sky. So if you have a true anisotropy in the sky, a detector that turns around its axis in a 24-year period and turns around the sun in one solar year, this anisotropy will show up exactly in this sidereal time scale. So you can see here this more clearly using Monte Carlo simulations. So this is the Fourier transform, the power spectrum of the Fourier transform of the time distribution of the event. In a controlled situation where you put 20% solar modulation on top of a 5% daily modulation, and you put an actual anisotropy on the sky, 1% anisotropy. And then you can clearly see power showing up at the solar scale, but you also see power in these two distinctive frequencies here, one sidereal, right, and one anti-sidereal. And so, and this thing here is coming essentially from this kind of effect. It's the superposition of these two modulations. And here is the sidereal where we usually look for anisotropies. So there is power, and there's power in excess to the anti-sidereal. So this excess power is coming from the actual dipole. So that's why we need to correct for these modulations before looking for anything at large scales. There's another effect, which is the geomagnetic effect. The geomagnetic field distorts the shower particle distribution at ground level. So this affects our shower size estimator, and it's a zenith angle dependent effect that would induce a large scale anisotropy in the sky. So I'm showing this because this gentleman sitting here in the first row is the responsible for this study. So he's, one of his PhD's thesis work was a geomagnetic effect. So Moritz will recognize many of the plots in this slides. So the point is that the geomagnetic field distorts the particles at ground, the particle distribution, so that if we look at this average signal of in a station as a function of the azimuth at ground, this signal is modulated. So this modulation is introduced by the geomagnetic field. It also distorts our shower size estimator. And the amplitude of the effect in the shower size estimator grows fast with zenith angle. So it's an effect that is really important for these inclined showers close to 60 degrees in zenith. So we have to correct for that. Otherwise, we will induce a dipole in the sky of about 2%. And the effect is such that the direction of the dipole points preferentially close to the south pole. So if you look at the distribution of dipoles induced by this kind of effect, you see that it peaks close to almost -90 degrees of declination, which is the south pole. So this is another effect that we need to correct. And finally, we have also to correct for the fact that the Auger is not constant. The effective collection area of the detector is not constant in time. So the first 4 years, basically, we were deploying tanks at ground, so the detector was growing. And then even when the detector was complete in 2008, the stations go in and out of data acquisition. So we have to keep track of how many of those 1,600 stations are working at every time an event lands. So this introduces a residual modulation at the end at the level of 0.5% that we have to correct. And so here's an analysis that we did and where we find a signal above this energy here. So the data set is, the period for the data set is this one, so more than 12 years of data. As I said, we do have this extra sky coverage, about 30%. Provided more with respect to the vertical sample provided by an inclined event. We also get some extra statistics by relaxing a little bit our fiducial triggers, and that's the total integrated exposure in this period here. Some almost 77,000 square kilometers star radian year. That's the final directional exposure sky map here in equatorial coordinates. So you see that we can see up to 40 degrees of northern declination. This is the exposure in galactic coordinates. And you can see here the South Pole, right? So this is South Pole. The South Pole in galactic coordinates. So the South Pole is all the time in our field of view, because it corresponds to zenith showers coming from zenith angle of about 55 degrees. So it's all the time in our field of view. Okay, so we do detect a dipole anisotropy above ATV. And the analysis, it's a two-step, two main steps analysis. We first establish the existence of the anisotropy, and then we reconstruct the three-dimensional properties of the dipole. So the analysis was done first by projecting the directions of the cosmic rays into the equatorial plane and doing a first harmonic analysis in this projected distribution. So here, just the first harmonic coefficient of this projected distribution. So there are some extra weights that are included in this so-called modified Rayleigh analysis, exactly to take into account the fact that the detector has a residual modulation as a function of time, and also to correct for the fact that we don't have a perfectly flat detector. So the stations are deployed at ground at different altitudes. And since the Andes is close by, you can see a slight change in the average altitude of these stations in the northwest direction. But once you have these coefficients, you can then estimate the amplitude and the phase of the first harmonic. And here is a summary of the results. We have looked into two energy bins, one that I'm going to call low energy bin, from 4 to 8 eV, and another a high energy bin. So this is just the number of events that we have in each bin. So you can see the amplitude of that first harmonic modulation in each bin, the phase in degrees. And the last column is important. This is the p-value. So that's the probability that these amplitudes are coming just from isotropic fluctuations in an isotropic sky. So you see that the low energy bin, this probability is pretty high, but the high energy bin, the probability is pretty low, at the order of 10 to the minus 8. Again, this is pre-trial, because we have looked into two energy bins, so fluctuations don't know about energy. They can pop up in any of the two energy bins. And when you penalize for that, this 10 to the minus 8 probability, which is a 5.6 sigma pre-trial, goes to 5.2 sigma, still highly statistically significant, and is still above the threshold for discovery. So it's a more than 5 sigma signal. And so once the anisotropy was established, we can then now try to reconstruct the direction of the dipole and its amplitude, because the previous slide, it was just a projected distribution in the equatorial plane. And it turns out that for a detector like Auger, we are sensitive to the two components of the dipole, the one that is aligned with the Earth's rotation axis and the one parallel to the equatorial plane, so the two components. The component parallel to the Earth's rotation axis is proportional to this coefficient here, B5, which is the equivalent, it's the equivalent of A alpha. But now instead of looking at the right ascension distribution, we can look at the azimuth distribution of the events. This is a local coordinate, the azimuth at which the shower enters. And it turns out that if you have a dipole in the sky for a detector like Auger, you induce an amplitude in the azimuthal distribution. And the perpendicular component is proportional to R alpha, which is the modulation that I've just discussed in the previous slide. Then you can get the right ascension and the declination of the dipole. Again, this is the summary. So this is the amplitude of the dipole in each energy bin. So in the high energy bin, it's a 6.5% dipole, pointing towards declination minus 25 degrees and right ascension 100 degrees. So here is the map in equatorial coordinates. So the dipole direction is more or less here. This is the galactic center. So in this hole, you would say something?
Yeah, I want to ask a question. So these dipoles component, so I assume you're taking all the events you have in your detector, but you don't, do you have an idea of where this dipole is coming from? Is it mainly from protons and
I'll discuss in a few slides. And all right.
So on your map, where is San A? Sorry, like relative to the dipole direction that you're.
In galactic, I know more or less in galactic coordinates. I have to put the. So San A somewhere.
So your dipole is not just like San A.
No, it's not. No, it's not San A. Yeah, I don't know exactly. Do you remember the coordinates of San A? Yeah, I haven't seen. But here in the it's not a single source signal for sure, because this is a single source in the sky would give you not a pure dipole, but it would give power in all smaller scales. And this I'm going to discuss in a few minutes. But that's a good question. Yeah. Can you get a dipole from a single source? You can, but you also get power at smaller scales, and this we don't see, as I'm going to discuss in a few seconds. But so this is the properties of the dipole, and here there's an assumption behind. So in order to reconstruct this dipole, you have to assume that there's a pure dipole in the sky. And then the question is this a reasonable assumption? And then we have extra evidence from our data set itself, but using completely independent estimator, which is the power spectrum. If you look at the power spectrum as a function of scale for the two energy bins again, so here everything is consistent with isotropy. The gray band here is a 99% confidence level for an isotropic sky. So the power spectrum is completely contained inside this region. But then when you look in the high energy band, you see this this striking thing that you have a dipole at L equal 1, and then you have nothing statistically significant in all the other scales. So it's like a pure dipole in the sky. So that's the answer for a question that a point source would give you quadrupole also in other multiples.
The power spectrum would be flat, I guess, is for point source.
Well, you would get some extra power at low energies, at higher multiple.
Even L.
Yeah.
Lots of even L that dies quickly. You would see power at like M equal 3 and M equal 4.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. I was just wondering how fast it dies off.
Right.
Depends on the size of the sample.
But this is pretty striking, right? Because you see from L equal 3 to L equal 2, it's a jump. Huh? So here's just also another test, just to make sure that we are not just seeing a fluctuation on the sky. So this is the p-value, that probability that the signal comes from isotropy as a function of basically time. So this is the integrated exposure, so you can pretty much read it as time, all the way from 2004 to at the end of 2016. So you just see a steady drop of this probability as you accumulate data. And so that's good, because fluctuations don't look like that, right? Fluctuations don't know about time. So this is the final sky mapping in galactic coordinates now with the direction of the dipole, right? So these are the galactic coordinates. So here there's a broad filter applied, and it's 45 degree top hat beam. And you see that the direction of the dipole is 125 degree away from the galactic center. So a galactic origin, a model based on a galactic origin for this cosmic rays, it's hard to fit in this picture. You would expect some correlation with the galactic center, or at least with the galactic plane. So here is the map in different coordinate system, equatorial, galactic. And here is another striking result, is that The dotted line here is the equator for the dipole, right? So the axis is here. There's got to be an equator here. And when you transform to supergalactic coordinate, it pretty much lines up with the supergalactic plane.
Yeah. What does that mean? Sorry, let's start electric.
If you look at the distribution of galaxies and in our neighborhood, you see that many of the structures close to us line up close to a plane, which is called the supergalactic plane. I'm going to show another slide in a few minutes.
5 minutes.
5 minutes, yeah, this is more than enough. So what is the reason for, what is the origin for this dipole? One origin that seems not to be the case is this cosmological Compton-Gedding effect. So you know that it's the CMB, there's a dipole, right? Planck measures that, WMAP measures that. It has to do with the bulk movement of the solar system in a frame where the CMB is isotropic, right? That generates a dipole of the order of 10 to the minus 3. The velocity, this is the number that I got from last Planck publication. That's the velocity in this reference frame. That's the direction where it points. So there's got to be an equivalent effect for cosmic rays, right? If we are moving with this direction across the CMB, we also should see a dipole in the cosmic ray flux. So instead of the temperature of the CMB, we are using the cosmic ray flux here. So this is relationship between the spectra in different frames. So this is in the CMB rest frame. This is in the observer frame. So yeah, there's got to be a dependence on the velocity. And there's got to be also a dependence on the shape of the spectra itself. So it turns out that the amplitude, when you plug in the numbers that are consistent with our spectrum in this energy region, you get a 0.6% amplitude. So this is too small. We are seeing a 6.5% dipole. So it's got to be a subleading effect in this thing. So we will need to detect this bulk movement in cosmic rays at 3 sigma level. We would need a million events. So we have a factor 10 less statistic at this point.
The direction also presumably is not the same direction, right?
Well, the movement, it's got to be, right? So if we are moving across the CMB, there's got to be a...
Your measured dipole presumably doesn't point in the same direction.
They are separated also. So the direction doesn't...
What matters is like the dipole. I mean, it's like the motion relative to your sources, not the CMB.
Right, but the assumption here behind is that, okay, so we are moving across the CMB, so assume that the astrophysical sources of ultra-high energy cosmic rays are distributed at cosmological distance and are on average at rest in this CMB frame. That's the hypothesis. Then you should see the equivalent effect in cosmic rays, the same number. Yeah. It's got to be there. Okay, so the supergalactic plane that I don't know if you guys can see it, but there is a brighter region here which starts to show up in the two mass distribution. So this is the supergalactic plane. So you see an accumulation of structures, more or less in the shape of a plane. So we have tested this hypothesis that okay, so if this cosmological Compton-Gedding effect cannot give you 6.5%. So what if you look at the sources close by, like the ones in two mass, and you put some magnetic deflection on top of these sources? So if you extract charged particles from these sources, put some magnetic field, at least the one in the galaxy, the galactic magnetic field, what is the large-scale distribution of arrival directions that you get for a detector like Auger? So that's basically what we did here. Took sources from two mass, these sources are up to 300 megaparsec, and then put some coherent magnetic field on top of that. We are using a particular magnetic field here due to Jensen and Glennis Farrar. And this magnetic field has basically three components: a spiral disk component that follows basically the structure of the spiral arms, a toroidal field at the halo, and a poloidal field. This model it has many free parameters that are fit to two classes of measurements, pulsar rotation measurements and synchrotron emission using WMAP maps. And when you do that, that's what you have. So this is the pure two-mass flux weighted dipole. If you weight each source in two mass by their infrared flux, and that's what you get for the dipole. It's 55 degrees away from the Auger dipole. And then you put magnetic deflections on top of it. Here are just two rigidities, so basically E over Z equal 2 and 5. So where does the direction shift, right? This coherent shift due to the galactic magnetic field. There's no extra galactic magnetic field here, neither a random component. The random component will basically blur the situation, but it wouldn't change the direction of the dipole, right?
How
would
the dipole you get from the two?
Well, the amplitude, we haven't looked at the amplitude because we know that in order to get the amplitude, you have to model the isotropic fraction, right? Here we are taking the closed by sources, but if you want to really get the amplitude, you have to assume what is the fraction that is coming from all the rest of the universe. And here was just an exercise to see if a magnetic deflection moves the dual mass dipole towards our dipole, and that's basically what is shown here. And again, this is just for two rigidities. The data has a whole distribution of rigidities, so you have to put this in. And as I said, this is a very a simple exercise, and I finish here. So we have done an isotropy search at several angular scales, a small, intermediate, and large. There are indications of anisotropy at the 4 sigma level from maximum likelihood analysis in this starburst galaxy model. We do observe a dipole at high energies above ATV at the 5 sigma level. The direction is far away from the galactic center, so it's better explained if the bulk of these cosmic rays are coming from outside the galaxy. And we see no statistically significant sign of anisotropy at low energies, meaning below ATV. That's it.
In these like propagation studies and so on, did you assume it's protons that the
In this case particular.
Yeah, or in general, how does the composition get
right? Right.
How does the interpretation of the dipole change, both if it's proton or if
right.
it's a heavy nuclei?
So here we have chosen these two rigidities in this particular case for a reason, right? If you look at our data, we do have other observables that are sensitive to the chemical nature of the primary particle, right? So if you look at these shower profiles, the atmospheric depth at which the shower is maximum is sensitive to the chemical, to the mass of the primary, right? When we look at energies around 10 eV, we see that typically the Z values that our data seems to be consistent range from 1.5 to 5, depending on the hadronic interaction model that you use to interpret the data. So we just took these two extremes here, and then took the energy of 10 eV, and then you end up with E over Z of this order. So these two rigidities is to be consistent with our own data set, right? But of course, if you now put a proton, a pure proton composition, the magnetic deflections are smaller than in the mixed composition case. So these coherent deflections will be less, right? So here it's consistent with our chemical composition. In the starburst analysis, we also did something that is consistent with our chemical composition because, as I said, we needed to account for energy losses. Energy losses depend on the mass of the primary. If it's proton, it will interact basically with the CMB. If it's heavier nuclei, it will interact with the extragalactic background light. And we have to assume a composition. And again, we have assumed a composition that best fits our spectrum and our XMAX data, this atmospheric maximum distribution.
Any more? Then let's thank the speaker again.